This is Kathy coming to you with readings from the News Gazette for today, which is Wednesday, the 19th of August. Starting with the front page headline, Research Audits of U of I and 29 Other Campuses Ordered by the Department of Defense by Abisola Dahunsi. The U.S. Department of Defense has directed the University of Illinois and 29 other colleges and universities to initiate immediate and comprehensive reviews of their academic, financial, and research collaborations with foreign entities of concern. U of I spokesman Patrick Wade confirmed to the News Gazette on Tuesday that the university has begun a coordinated review of the department's requests and will work with the federal agency to provide a response. The university takes seriously its responsibility to safeguard the U.S. research enterprise, protect sensitive and export-controlled research, and comply with applicable federal research security requirements while also supporting appropriate and transparent academic engagement, Wade said in an email. The university did not provide a copy of the letter or additional details about the specific information requested. Without naming universities individually, the Department of Defense announced this week that it had issued formal notifications to 30 domestic academic institutions, action designed to protect American taxpayer-funded research investments from unauthorized technology transfer, intellectual property theft, and adversarial exploitation. The department gave universities until August 31st to report their findings and actions. The letter comes as the federal government has increased scrutiny of foreign influence and research security risks at U.S. universities. The department, which President Donald Trump's administration has referred to as the Department of War, has implemented new research security requirements that could affect federal funding based on certain international collaborations, foreign funding, patents, and affiliations with entities on federal restricted lists. According to the U of I's Office of Research Security, the Defense Department's updated rules, which took effect this year, can require mitigation measures or affect eligibility for federal funding when researchers have certain connections to foreign entities. The U of I said the rules can apply to factors that include collaborations with prohibited entities and certain foreign talent recruitment programs. The university also has warned researchers about changes to a federal list of foreign academic and research institutions considered to pose risks of misappropriation of U.S.-funded research. The updated list, released July 23rd, added more than 25 institutions in China, Russia, and Iran, according to a U of I research security notice. State Senator Chapin Rose, Republican of Mahomet, said federal scrutiny of security is understandable given the breadth of research conducted at the U of I. It's no surprise that the U of I is on this list simply because of the amount of research that's done here, Rose told the News Gazette. He noted that the university's research spans areas that can have national security or economic implications, including computer hardware and software and scientific research. It's just foreign theft of intellectual property and secrets, said Rose, who emphasized that he was speaking generally about research security and was not commenting on the contents of the letter sent to Illinois. The U of I is among the nation's leading public research universities and conducts research across fields that include engineering, computer science, agriculture, medicine, and the sciences. Wade said the university's response to the Department of Defense is being coordinated among appropriate campus offices. Transparent and secure international collaborations create perspectives that deepen our understanding of global challenges, promote scientific discovery, and strengthen U.S. innovation, Wade said. The university has not said whether the federal request could result in changes to any existing international research relationships or whether any specific researchers or programs are under investigation. In this week's announcement, Emil Michael, Undersecretary for Research and Engineering, said the Defense Department has zero tolerance for academic partnerships that compromise our national security. Institutions that receive funding from American taxpayers must uphold the highest standards of research security, and these mandated audits will ensure accountability across the board, added Joseph Jewell, Assistant Secretary for Science and Technology. Universities are critical partners in executing a wide range of Department of War research programs, and the department must therefore ensure that our research investments are well protected from foreign exploitation. Multiple national media outlets, including Fox News and The Guardian, reported the full list of institutions that received directives from the Pentagon. The 30 reported included Southern Illinois Carbondale and the Illinois Institute of Technology, as well as four of the U of I's Big Ten conference peers, Minnesota, Penn State, UCLA, and USC. Their role is instrumental. There's a picture of band members, members of the Marching Illini, and they're standing in a circle on a football field, and it's all filled with students. Members of the Marching Illini gather at their practice field on campus on Champaign, in Champaign on day one of outdoor training camp. Band 158 with 420 students reported Sunday and began practicing outside a day later, a session that included a Q&A with Illinois Athletic Director Josh Whitman. It's a big week for Director Barry Hauser's band, which will take part in Thursday's Sights and Sounds at Geese Memorial Stadium and Friday's new student convocation at the State Farm Center. In addition to campus events, the Marching Illini in November will participate in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade in New York City. There are several other pictures in here. Color Guard members twirling their flags during practice, and band members playing with volleyballs and footballs just to get loose. Marching Illini Director Barry Hauser is speaking to his band by a microphone, a picture of the drum majors helping the band warm up, and then a picture of Josh Whitman taking questions for him to answer from the members of the band. Also on the front page, Champaign County Board. Sudden walkout brings quick end to home rule referendum talks by Jane Obersman. A binding referendum asking voters if Champaign should become a home rule county is off the table for the November election after six county board members walked out mid-meeting, depriving the body of a quorum. The special county board meeting took place Monday, the last possible day for local municipal boards to adopt resolutions to put binding or advisory questions on the ballot for November, according to the Illinois State Board of Election. Proponents on the referendum say that home rule authority is a necessity if the county wants to ban data centers. However, board member John Farney, who organized the walkout, feels that the county doesn't have enough information yet on this matter or other ramifications of moving to home rule status. When the special meeting was called for on Thursday, a very short notice, before a meeting with an absolute deadline for the issue to get on the ballot, I started talking to individual board members to feel them out on their opinions, Farney said. According to Farney, the group that walked out included himself, Aaron Esri, Ed Sexton, John Cagle, Ben Crane, and Brent Pugh. Pugh was the lone Democrat of the bunch. The board initially had a quorum following roll call with 17 members present and 5 absent. However, Farney and the others walked out not long after that, which lowered the number of present members to 11, one shy of the 12 needed for a quorum, Farney said. This left County Executive Steve Summers with no choice but to close the meeting about 3 minutes in. In addition to the proposed binding referendum on home rule status, the board also had been poised to vote Monday on whether to put an advisory question on the November 3rd ballot. The question would have polled voters on whether Champaign County, in the event it moved to home rule, should use that additional authority to ban the development or construction of large data centers in its jurisdiction. Non-home rule counties cannot ban or prohibit otherwise permitted business operations such as data centers, Champaign County State's Attorney Julia Reitz told the News Gazette. They can implement temporary moratoriums and zoning rules, which is what is currently happening here. County Board Member Emily Rodriguez, a Democrat who chairs the board's Data Center Activities Task Force, said that while Monday's meeting didn't go the way she hoped, big ideas take time. We won't get that ban through the work on the task force or anything coming from the county board, she said. All we can do is regulate. So we did everything we could to give voters that option to say that, no, we are not interested in any large-scale data centers in Champaign County. And the option was taken away. But I mean by people who are elected. The Data Center Task Force's objectives are to analyze issues related to the data center development and recommend potential changes to the county's zoning ordinance to counter these issues. The county has placed a one-year ban on the development of data centers with at least 10,000 square feet of processing area. The moratorium is currently set to end in April and is intended to give the task force time to work on the matter. Farney said he wants more information on what the county can and can't do right now without home rule authority. From what I understand, what we can do right now is we can regulate and put rules and conditions on the construction of data centers, he said. If a data center company wants to do business in Champaign County, they can comply by our rules. We can make our rules pretty stringent. If they don't like those rules, they can go somewhere else. He'd like to see the task force create an ordinance that the county board can vote on, and he feels that moving forward with the home rule proposal would be subverting that process. There are some people that are complaining about, oh, we took something away from the voters or something like that. No, that's not the case at all. We need to have information before we can vote on something, he added. And putting a special meeting together on the day of the deadline to put something on the ballot is not the best way to go about to try to be successful at something. As for whether the referendum proposal could return in another election year, Rodriguez said she's still committed to talking about it. It didn't seem to die, she said. I think there's a long-standing interest in finally having a conversation on home rule and, more importantly, what kind of county government folks want. I think it's predictable that we are going to encounter big, complicated problems that we cannot address with the tools that we currently have, as afforded by the state constitution. She added that none of the county board members were interested in using home rule to raise property taxes. Pew, however, has expressed skepticism about the county's motives and feels that there are better ways to stop large data centers. Here we go with home rule, he wrote in a recent Facebook post. If you want your taxes raised right away without your say, this is what you vote for. Farm Family of the Week. Meet the Shields family of Fisher. And there's a picture of Deborah and Paul Shields sitting in Adirondack chairs outside. They are both dressed in blue and white. They both have gray hair. Mrs. Shields wears glasses. Well, they both wear glasses. And they look like they're really enjoying the sunshine. Deborah and Phil Shields' country cottage farm in rural Fisher leans into agrotourism by offering an event space that seats up to 50 people. They have hosted bridal and baby showers, private luncheons, and workshops. Meet the Shields family of Fisher. A multitude of grain, a ton of beef, and a steady stream of customers help the first-generation country cottage farm in rural Fisher run smoothly. Together, Deborah and Phil Shields welcome people year-round, whether it's for special events, picking vegetables or flowers, meat sales, or even a pumpkin patch. How long has your family been farming? Phil has been doing commercial farming for 54 years. The Shields family farm is a grain operation. I've been gardening for over 60 years. And where is it? Our home farm is located 2 miles south of Fisher. Our pastures and fields bordering our farm are across the road from the Sangamon Forest Preserve. Why did your family come to this area and where do they come from? Phil grew up west of Rantoul. When I met him, I was living in Warrenville, a suburb 40 miles west of Chicago, between Wheaton and Naperville. I'm originally from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Phil and I bought this farm about 15 years ago. We loved the layout of the land and the Wildcat Creek that runs through the pasture. The house on the property was livable with upgrades, new windows, and geothermal to make the house more energy efficient. What does your operation consist of? Is it strictly grain, livestock, or other? At our country cottage farm, we grow alfalfa, corn, rye, and soybeans. Phil has his cow-calf operation. He sells bulls that make the cut at New Day Genetics in Missouri. After retiring from having a group daycare here in our home that initially started in Warrenville, I retired and started a small gift shop here on our farm and expanded to sell our beef and we raise here on our farm. We offer local and handmade gifts from the surrounding area. We do have some items such as metal garden art sculptures that were made by artists in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. How many people in the family does the operation support? Our farm supports the two of us. How many generations of farmers are there? Country Cottage Farm is a first-generation farm. My daughter helped with some of the brochures and materials we used to promote our farm. Phil's son has helped with feeding cows and calves when Phil was addressing health issues. Do you have any members of your family in the operation working other jobs? Nope, we do not. This is our full-time job. What's your favorite snack when farming? When I'm out in the garden, I love to eat a few fresh raspberries or sugar snap peas in the spring. Best agricultural movie and why? We haven't seen any lately, but we enjoyed a PBS documentary on George Washington Carver and the research he did at Iowa State in Ames, Iowa. While on the farm, I can't live without a cell phone or internet. You need a way to communicate in case of emergency and connect with the outside world living in a rural area. The best lesson agriculture has taught me is patience. Farming can put you on an emotional roller coaster. There are so many variables affecting farming, from government policy to the cost of inflation for equipment versus yields, weather, and climate change. And how have you seen farming change over the years? It is so expensive to run a profitable farming business, especially if you have not acquired land passed down from your family. Phil is now able to dictate his calving seasons with artificial insemination. Your farm equipment? John Deere. What makes farming such a good vocation? Being self-employed, being able to connect with nature, and having a connection with the four seasons we experience in East Central Illinois. What soil conservation practices do you employ? Minimal tilling. We use the cow manure to spread back in the field to fertilize and amend the soil with organic material. And what's the best time of the year to be on the farm? Spring. When you plant seeds, summer for the sun and heat to help crops grow. And the anticipation of fall when you harvest the grain crops. What are the other areas of interest for your family? We have done some traveling to gardens all over the world, including Illinois, Iowa, Arizona, Minnesota, Maryland, Brazil, Japan, and the Netherlands. These gardens have given me inspiration for my own gardens here on the farm. I also enjoy bike riding and kayaking when I visit my daughter in Minneapolis. Phil has grown children and grandchildren who live within an hour's drive from the farm. 97 new citizens take oath of allegiance in Chicago. Court data shows naturalizations are plummeting under Trump by Maggie Doherty. 97 new citizens from 34 countries swore allegiance to the U.S. at a ceremony Tuesday in the Dirksen Federal Courthouse in Chicago. The group of new citizens is substantially smaller than the nearly 1,000 who were sworn in at Wrigley Field this time last year, and it is representative of a broader trend. According to the numbers provided by the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Illinois, the court administered fewer than 4,500 naturalizations in the first 7 months of the year. That's roughly a quarter of the 16,580 it averaged for the same period over each of the last 4 years, and down over 75% from this time last year. More than 300 new citizens are expected to be naturalized today at the State Fair in Springfield. Edwin Yonka, Director of Communications and Public Policy for the ACLU of Illinois, said that reduction is no accident, but rather the outcome of a deliberate design by the Trump administration. The administration has nearly gutted the existing legal pathways to citizenship, all while it actively tries to denaturalize people who have lived in and contributed to the United States for decades, Yonka said in an email to Capital News Illinois. This reflects a reckless disregard for our national history and tradition and for the positive economic and cultural impact that new citizens bring to our communities. The administration's blind loathing of immigrants is doing harm to our nation that will take decades to repair. The naturalization exam saw major revisions under the federal administration in October, when it expanded the pool of potential questions, shifted to a greater emphasis on U.S. history and the Constitution, and increased the number of correct answers required to pass to 12 out of 20 from the previous requirement of 6 out of 10. A policy memorandum issued last August also instituted a new holistic assessment, requiring citizenship candidates to demonstrate good moral character through positive societal contributions, rather than just the absence of a criminal record. In a statement, U.S. Citizen and Immigration Services spokesman Zach Kaler said the change is reflective of a shift from the Biden administration, which he alleged prioritized rubber stamping applications with minimal vetting. U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services under the leadership of President Trump is implementing rigorous screening and vetting processes across the country, Kaler said. USCIS will not take shortcuts in the naturalization process. For the 97 new citizens in Chicago, it was a day of celebration. Hyosu Carranza, 26, came to the U.S. 12 years ago from his home country of Honduras. Though he said Honduras is a good country, he said America provided more opportunities. This is the country for your dreams to come true, so that's the reason why I came here, Carranza said. To start a new life in a country where my rights and my dreams, they feel protected. Carranza, now a driver for FedEx, dreams of opening a construction business and is currently studying for a masonry exam, a passion he developed through years of walking Chicago streets and looking up at its historic brick building. To open a business in Honduras would not have been possible for him, he said, due to gang violence and threats from criminal organizations. Now he says he'll sit for his masonry exam in October. For Maria de Los Angeles Marufo, 49, becoming a citizen is all about getting the right to vote. When she came to the U.S. from Mexico 3 decades ago, De Los Angeles Marufo said she was single and looking for a better future. Now her 3 adult children are grown, and it's time to do something for herself, she said. Becoming a U.S. citizen was part of that journey. I feel so blessed that I have this opportunity to become a citizen, she said. Now I have the opportunity to vote, so my voice is going to be heard. I am so happy to be here. And now the Jim Day Opinion Column. GOP candidate charges Pritzker has ill-served the public. Growing up a Republican in Democratic Cook County wasn't easy for Aaron Del Mar. Neither was competing in wrestling and judo at Indiana University. But the Republican candidate for lieutenant governor in the November election figures the hard knocks prepared him for the rigor of a dog-eat-dog political campaign. That makes me uniquely qualified, said the 47-year-old Del Mar. The Palatine resident is running in the gubernatorial ticket headed by Darren Bailey, who is making his second run for governor. He lost 4 years ago to incumbent Democrat Governor J.B. Pritzker. Del Mar, who is half white and half Filipino, was making the political rounds Tuesday in East Central Illinois, stopping by WDWS radio for an interview before heading to an appearance in Danville. He plans to attend Republican Day on Thursday at the Illinois State Fair, but he has personal business planned for Wednesday. My daughter is moving into Bromley Hall on the University of Illinois campus, said Del Mar, the father of 6 children, a businessman, and an entrepreneur. But politics is his principal vocation for now, and he and Bailey have their hands full challenging a multi-billionaire 2-term Democratic governor in a Democratic state. Del Mar's visit Tuesday coincided with news reports that Pritzker has made another huge deposit, $65 million, into his campaign treasury. But Del Mar has a ready response to the money issue. You can't buy your way out of 7.5 years of failure, he said. Del Mar said he and Bailey have identified 3 key areas in need of improvement in Illinois. He cited skyrocketing local property taxes that are partially caused by the state taking an excessive share of income tax revenue from municipalities. That, he said, causes local governments to raise taxes. He blasted Pritzker's standing on public safety, citing the governor's decision to sign the Social Justice Safety Act into law. The legislation abolished the bond system and makes it easy for accused criminals to be released after making an initial court appearance. Finally, he said test results show that K-12 public education performance in Illinois is substandard and must be improved. Del Mar has a limited political background. He's the highway commissioner in his township and oversees a staff of 7. He's also served as the GOP chairman of Cook County. Del Mar said he's fascinated by the nuts and bolts of government operations and is always looking for ways to save money and improve services. As a consequence, he said, if the Bailey-Del Mar ticket is elected in November, he'll have 2 big jobs. Del Mar said he will oversee the transition team that will identify state department heads and key employees in the Bailey administration. Good government starts with these appointments, he said. Further, he will be charged with taking a microscopic look at the much-abused process of awarding state grants. State grant money has been repeatedly exploited by bad actors who've taken advantage of weak or sometimes non-existent state oversight. I want to create a grant dashboard that will outline every step of the process for taxpayers, Del Mar said. Del Mar holds degrees from both Indiana University and the University of Illinois. He said he decided to get involved in running for office because he brings a set of skills and qualities to the table that are good both for taxpayers and public policy. I know what to do, and I enjoy doing it, Del Mar said. This is J. Mark Powell's Holy Cow History. He really did sink it. The U-boat skipper peered through the periscope and smiled. It looked like such an easy target. And indeed it was, yet going after it sealed his doom while also setting in motion a series of events that made another man a hero and triggered official denial of his valor. And it all happened right in America's backyard. Hans Gunther Kuhlmann, 28, commanded a U-166, a brand new submarine in service for barely 6 months, sent to fight Nazi Germany's newest enemy, the United States. It prowled the Gulf of Mexico just a few miles off the coast. It was fertile hunting ground. In the last 2 weeks, U-166 had sent 3 American cargo ships to the bottom. Now, on the night of July 30, 1942, Kuhlmann was going after the biggest prize yet. The SS Robert E. Lee was a steam passenger ship that carried wartime cargo. It had left Trinidad bound for Tampa, Florida. The threat of U-boats lurking nearby had diverted it to New Orleans. At 10:37 p.m., Kuhlmann gave the order, "Fire." Lookouts on the Lee spotted the torpedoes speeding their way, but there was no time to take evasive action. Within 15 minutes, the Robert E. Lee was another maritime casualty. All but 25 of its 407 passengers and crews were rescued. Then U-166's getaway was foiled because Kuhlmann didn't know the Lee had a secret ace up its sleeve. Sailing ahead of it was Patrol Coastal 566, a small submarine chaser. While other vessels and aircraft were busy rescuing Lee's survivors, PC 566 had a job to do. Lieutenant Commodore Herbert Claudius turned the small ship around and raced into the torpedo's wake at full speed. Within minutes, he dropped the depth charges. An oil slick soon surfaced. Claudius radioed that he had destroyed the German sub, and that should have been that. Except it wasn't. A Navy review board investigated and not only ruled there was no way that 566 had sunk the U-boat as claimed, but it also criticized Claudius's tactics and scolded him. Utterly humiliated, he was stripped of his command and sent back to the submarine chaser version of basic training. It was like an adult child being forced to repeat a school grade that he had failed. Even worse came 2 days after the Lee's sinking. A Coast Guard plane spotted and attacked a U-boat. It was credited with destroying the U-166. In fact, it had only damaged a different U-boat. With that, the Navy closed the book on the incident. Claudius served with distinction for the rest of the war and afterward. Yet the stain of the incident followed him wherever he went. The men of the PC-566 adamantly insisted they had sunk a sub that night. Claudius believed so, too, right up till he died in 1981. Then, 15 years later, new technology changed everything. While making an underwater survey of the Gulf floor for an oil company in 1986, oceanographers discovered what appeared to be two wrecks. The first was soon confirmed to be the Robert E. Lee. In 2001, the remains of U-166 were positively identified just over a mile away. In December 2014, Secretary of the Navy Ray Mabus presented Herbert Claudius Jr. with the Legion of Merit posthumously awarded to his father. It took 72 years, but the U.S. belatedly admitted that not the lieutenant commander had gotten it all wrong. As it turned out, Claudius and his small crew had scored the only sinking of a German U-boat in the Gulf of Mexico during World War II. The individual who writes this, Mark Powell, is a novelist, a former TV journalist, and a die-hard history buff. Severe weather. Paxton Mayor declares local state of emergency by Will Brumlevy. Mayor Bill Engel declared a local state of emergency as the city continued to work to secure resources, including financial assistance from the state and federal governments to help residents impacted by the roughly 10 inches of rainfall that Paxton received over a two-day period late last week. "This level of rainfall is beyond anything our infrastructure was built to withstand," Engold said. "Our storm sewers, engineered for our once-in-generation event, have received such an event daily for multiple days in a row. Our stormwater systems, pumping stations, roads, and utilities have operated at or beyond capacity for days on end. That's why I'm convening this meeting. We must address urgent public safety measures, from road closures to service restoration to us formalizing our pursuit of state and federal disaster assistance, which depends on timely action by the city. We must begin this long, arduous process of rebuilding what has been damaged by these storms. I do not believe the city can afford to wait." After voting to concur with the mayor's determination that an emergency exists necessitating the meeting, the seven aldermen present approved amending Chapter 34 of the City Code regarding the establishment of the Paxton Emergency Response Service to enact standards regarding the declaration of a local state of emergency. City Attorney Tony Schuring said the council's actions allow the mayor the maximum amount of authority that a non-home rule municipality can give to respond to the flooding without further council approval. And that's the end of Part 1 for today. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with Part 2.